Dear friends, this morning we touched on individual suffering and happiness, and how sometimes we cultivate what we think will give us joy and happiness, but actually it might offer us suffering and those around us suffering. And we had a little bit of fun with the hooch, and there was a question or an inquiry around what is your hooch, something that you think is offering you happiness, but truly it may offer you and those around you suffering. And we looked at it from an individual perspective, but of course we can also look at it from a much wider perspective, from a collective perspective. However, before we go there, I think happiness is such an important matter, is such a serious matter, happiness is such a serious matter, that I think we need to just spend a little bit more time on it before we move this evening to a more collective perspective. So another little story, only a short story. In 2001, I went to Plum Village for the first time. And I saw Thay, and I realized I'd found my teacher. He hadn't spoken. He hadn't spoken, and I realized as soon as he walked that this was my teacher, because he embodied the peace and the happiness and the joy with every step that he took. So he didn't need to say anything. He just needed to be there. Like he says in many of his books, it's not just about us making peace, we have to be peace. So we walk into a room, we spend time with our family, and we're not talking about it. We're not saying, oh, I've been on a great retreat. I hope you say that, but you don't say that type of thing. They can see by your presence, by your solidity, by being totally focused on your loved one or your family or your friends or your neighbor's presence, that you truly are peace. And that's what attracted me to Thay and this tradition. And then later, even better, I found out it was an engaged Buddhist tradition. So using spirituality, using mindfulness, to actually go into the world, taking mindfulness off the cushion and into the world to create peace. So I came back after a week at Plum Village, and I thought, yeah, this is good. So what do I do next? There wasn't a sangha. I used to live in Manchester. There wasn't a sangha in Manchester at the time. So on a Saturday, when my wife was a nurse and my daughter was at dance school, I'd have the house to myself. So I'd have a day of mindfulness. I'd sit for a while. I'd walk for a while. You can tell how long ago this is. I'd listen to cassette tapes. Yep, some of you won't know what cassette tapes are, will you? But there was cassette tapes of Thay. And I'd listen to those cassette tapes. Then I'd have a mindful meal. Perhaps read a book of Thay's. However, not many of my mates had heard of Thich Nhat Hanh. Quite a lot of my friends used to like watching football on a Saturday afternoon, and I happened to have a season ticket. So on the Saturday afternoon, I would go and watch football. And having spent some time in the army, my speech wasn't particularly skillful. And the team that I supported wasn't very good. And for some reason, the referee and the lines people always were making mistakes. So unskillful speech came up quite regularly, along with my friends who were egging me on, along with most of the crowd as well. And this carried on for a while. And then I realized that really something that I thought was giving me a great deal of happiness, that the mindfulness in the morning that was giving me at last, this peace that I'd sought for, well, I hadn't sought it because I didn't know what it was, but this peace was there in the morning. I'd learned a little bit, so I began to look at some of my suffering. I was a little bit calmer. My wife is a down-to-earth woman, said, you've changed, Dean, you've changed. And what she meant was I wasn't getting as angry, or my fuse was slowing down a little bit. And she was encouraging me to meditate. But then in the afternoon, all those old patterns were coming back, those unskillful patterns. So I did a little bit of an inventory of the things that were really cultivating and nourishing my happiness, my peace, and the things that were not. And unfortunately, even though I had a season ticket, I passed it on because it wasn't really nourishing my happiness. It really wasn't cultivating my peace. And I didn't have the solidity of practice to go along to a football match and not be swayed by the crowd. I didn't have that equanimity. I didn't have that balance. I was swayed. So I gave up my season ticket. And I used to travel all the way to down to Birmingham, which was the nearest sangha at the time, to practice, because that was nourishing my happiness. And I lost some friends because of it, but I also found some really other enjoyable activities that again nourished my happiness. And I regularly relook at my life to see what is feeding my happiness, my peace, my joy, my compassion, and what's my hooch. I inquire about regularly, looking in the mirror, Dean, what's your hooch? What are the things that you think are going to cultivate your happiness? But they're not really. And that doesn't mean I immediately get rid of them like I did my season ticket. But it does mean that I recognize them. I accept them. I embrace what is there. And I look deeply at the causes and conditions of my suffering that sometimes I think is happiness. I thought I'd just offer that before I move to what I had intended to offer as a reflection. It sort of came to me as I was walking here. Just for information, I do now actually go and watch the football. The team that I support is now a very good team. So I'm not triggered hardly at all, because they normally win most of the time. And what Ty would say is not about football, but just in terms of suffering and being triggered, is when you have the capacity, know what your capacity is. For example, I couldn't have walked into prison 20 years ago. It would have triggered too many unwholesome seeds within me. Anger would have come up. I'd have been triggered by it. So Ty often says, be aware of your wholesome seeds and unwholesome seeds, and the level of mindfulness that you have. I'm just going to invite a bell, because that wasn't intended. I just thought of it as I was walking here. Joseph Goldstein is a respected American Dharma teacher, and sometimes he speaks of Plato's Republic, Plato, an ancient Greek philosopher, and he speaks of it to help, it helps me, to remember and to understand the fruits of the practice, the fruits of the Dharma, the fruits of what we're doing here. He speaks of a cave, and he speaks of a number of people facing the wall of the cave, chained to each other. Behind them is a fire, and there are people passing the fire, involved in their daily activities. The people that are chained and looking at the wall see the reflection of the people going about their activities as shadows on the cave. And because they are chained so tightly, because they are not free, they believe the shadows on the cave to be the ultimate reality, to be the truth, to be what is. Their perception is that this is it. This is it. This is what's going on. Some individuals, but more importantly, a collective energy, a collective effort, like we have here as Sangha, like we have at home as Sangha, means that some individuals begin to loosen their chains, and they turn around, and they see that behind them is a fire and people walking. And really, these shadows in front of the cave, in front of them, are not the true reality. With support of Sangha, with great effort, with volition to be free from wrong perception, some actually break free and see ultimate reality for what it is, with courage, with a stretched heart, with compassion, and then can go into the world, and because they have transformed their own suffering, have the energy, volition, and ability to help transform others. I found that image very helpful, because I don't know about you, I can still be imprisoned by my fear, by my illusion of what is true, by too much social media, by conversations. And I see shadows rather than the reality of things. Thai Thich Nhat Hanh helps with this. Also, he uses the word that some of you will know. He uses the word into being. So if we take the prefix into and then being, we have a new verb, into being. And what he's trying to do there is talk to us about everything is being connected. He used to do at Plum Village, is hold up a bit of paper and say, if you are a poet, if you are an artist, you can see the cloud in this paper. Because without the cloud, there wouldn't be rain. Without the rain, there wouldn't be a tree. And without the tree and many other things, there wouldn't be paper. So the paper and the cloud are interconnected. Everything is interconnected, of course, which means we are all empty of a separate self. We are all made up of the elements. Without you, there cannot be me. And without me, there cannot be you. Everything is interconnected. So if everything is interconnected, your happiness is my happiness, your suffering is my suffering, the world's suffering is my suffering. Yes, yes, we are all interconnected, we're interconnected with everything that is. However, sometimes, just sometimes, I don't know about you, I think I'm the center of it. I think it's me, yeah, I'm, you know? And everything else is serving, it's got to serve me. Like my gorgeous 3-year-old grandson. However, that isn't true, is it? We are interconnected. However, we are not at the center of everything. And sometimes because of this delusion that I have, I can have suffering, and that suffering then affects the world that I live in. Not just my partner, my wife, if I have a grumpy day. Not just my daughter, not just my grandson, not just my work friend. But it goes wider and wider. And we can cause great suffering if we choose not to look deeply, if we choose not to stretch ourselves, if we choose not to have a compassionate heart, which requires us to look deeply. So now we're moving towards collective suffering. And I do wonder, my dear friend, if you'd be happy to speak, because I've been speaking a fair bit.
Thank you, Dean.
Yeah.
I think I want to bring another level to it, and really from the point of not being whatever. So there is this understanding how one is, or how we interbe, you know, that this web of life is really supporting and enabling each other, you know, on this level, you know, in the paper is the whole world, you know, goes back to the Big Bang, yeah, it's all here. Or the song of Joni Mitchell, "We Are Stardust." Mm. So one could say, from this perspective, because we are not independent, there's not an independently existent self, absolutely. And I think where is for me also real excitement, and some of you know I teach a lot, very much influenced by my late friend Rob Bobea, it's also the understanding that actually the world is arising according how we relate to it. So we can't even say, oh, there is Dean, he's somehow connected with me because of the web network of life, but I can also see that my way of relating will actually influence how I perceive you, myself, and so forth. Does it make sense when I'm saying this? Yeah. So this is another layer of more maybe, and I'm hesitant, of codependent arising. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, rather than sometimes the two things get intermixed, mm-hmm. interbeing mm-hmm. and codependent mm-hmm. arising. Both have a real beauty to it, and both have a real depth of opening up to it, and both have different unfoldings and of practice and freedom they bring. Just want to say this. So this is why I was hesitating. I don't know how to put it in words in this context. So thank you.
I was hoping Kirsten was going to offer. Would you like to speak more or not?
No. It's your evening.
Oh, it's not my evening. An evening with Dean.
I'm not doing your work.
Oh, come on, come on. We inter are. Another way to look at things, which may help us with our suffering, with this notion of a separate self, again, is something that Thay uses regularly, is about the wave and the ocean, which I'll go through quickly because a number of you will have heard it before. But it's important. So let's imagine we're a wave on the ocean. And we see another wave. And that wave is bluer than we are. It's bigger than we are. And it seems to be just flowing a little bit more easy than we are. Then it's possible that we might have an inferiority complex. And we might really want to be as big as that wave. We might actually get a little jealous because we might want to be that blue. And the big wave, looking at us as the little wave, might have a superiority complex because, oh, I'm quite big here and that's such a small wave. The small wave may also be thinking about having some equality going on and may begin to get an equality complex. So already there's lots of separation going on just from two waves, one big, one small, one a different color, blue. However, if the waves looked a bit closer, they'd realize that all the waves rise and they fall. And they fall into the sea that they all come from. And ultimately, they are one because they are the sea. And if they realized that they all manifested from the sea, and they all went back to the sea, there'd be less chance of them believing that they are separate. They are separate. And it's easy for us to understand this, isn't it? It's easy to understand. But in my everyday life, it's difficult to realize. Yeah, there is that separation sometimes. And I cannot always be connected with someone else. My relationship with people that don't have the same political views as me, my relationship with people that I think are doing things that I have a couple of community interest companies that advocate for the rights of people. And it's very easy for me to advocate and to open my heart to people that I believe are not respected or, in my view, treated as they could be. It's very easy for me to open my heart and to understand that situation. However, sometimes I find it difficult to love the people that I believe, that some policymakers perhaps that I'm talking to, who I believe if they changed some of their policies, people might not be in poverty or have some of their rights, their human rights, violated. However, I've just told you 3 or 4 minutes ago that we're all one. However, it's more difficult to actually put it into practice. It's more difficult to stretch that heart when we're in the heat of the fire. So how do we do that? How do we really move from the notions of interdependence, interconnection, we're all one? How do we move from that notion in this Dharma hall to actually, when we're in the fire, having that stability, having that equanimity, in order that we see the other person, the person that I think, might be able to support somebody a little better? How do we do that? How we attempt to do that is by most of the matches have been burnt, only those ones.
Most of the matches have been burnt.
Let's see if I can find one. You have a look. I've got one here, yes. From the top. So imagine this as the notion, the things that you've read in books, the things that Kirsten and I have spoken about, the things when you're in Dharma sharing or with sanghas that you speak about and you think about on your own as you're walking. So that's the notion, that's the concept. What Thay would say is we need to realize it, and he would say that the flame is when we realize it, is when we can still have that open heart that we've spoken about in the heat of the fire. And it is truly open. We're not just thinking it. It's happening. We can feel it. Yes, I love you. I understand you. Because then, because we spoke about it last night, didn't we? We said, when there is true compassion, even if we're saying things that are perhaps not what everybody wants to hear, they're received, that relationship is a little different because our heart has stretched and we're holding everyone. How do we get to that? How do we move and get to that? Non-conventional, non-conceptual wisdom is helpful. Touching the earth, letting go. So this morning and yesterday morning, we practiced the three earth touchings. We surrendered to the earth. We were held by the earth that doesn't discriminate. Doesn't discriminate at all. It takes everybody. It takes everything. And Thay would say, it turns everything into flowers. So when we were touching the earth, sometimes I don't think it's that non-conceptual wisdom, along with the conceptual wisdom, that helps my heart grow, that helps open me up, that lets go of my notions. And when I'm practicing with Sangha, the energy of the Sangha supports me to let go, because I know others are letting go too. Others are practicing in order to open their hearts. Open their hearts. So we can engage with the world. So we can take this peace, this stability, this happiness, this joy, off the meditation cushion, out of Gaia House, and into the world. Please say something.
Oh, Dean. So I just want to acknowledge that we also have slightly different language, you know, with non-conceptual wisdom and conceptual wisdom. It's not my vocabulary.
Am I being clear about what that is?
I just really wanted to mention But you know, maybe ask the Sangha. I think part of, if we maybe rather than make law, there is conceptual wisdom and then there is non-conceptual wisdom, I phrase it a little bit different and I don't completely meet it, it's a slightly different thing. We could say there is our habitual ways of seeing, which we take as true. This is how it is. And then there are teachings which point out again this, look actually, if you look closer, if you really sense what is happening, what you perceive as real is dependent arising and how you perceive it. You know, this is my little...
And I get it.
Yeah. So we are not just... having like stepping into like a compassionate and kind heart, you know, and then meet the thing outside there with compassion and kindness, the very the very experience, inner, outer, we are meeting with a heart mind that is resonating with compassion and kindness, will actually shape how it is perceived.
Yep, yep.
So it's not staying the same.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm starting to wheeze again.
Oh.
Interesting. So when we then take the notion of, you know, if we say, oh, this is like how we perceive the world, this is how we decide it, this is how it's real, and then there is an opening up of God, we can really, really open up more and more this understanding. It becomes actually more and more open and fluid and spacious, if we would call this, for now, it's not exactly the non-conceptual, but it's more like a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just see where I wanted to go with this. So I think where I wanted to go with it is that one of the steps is not creating an other duality of conceptual and non-conceptuality. Mm-hmm. It gets now really, it sounds very theoretical, but it's really not. It's really not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just want to say this. I find this really to see this in our experience. One of the really radical teachings for me of the Buddha is like, question how you perceive. Question how you perceive. Yeah. And what are perceptions that open something up, you know, that open up more sense of oneness, of non-separation. Yeah. And what are perceptions which really, really create the different waves big time.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know them. Anger, hate, fear. Yeah, that's what they do. That's what they do. And we all know or can see the qualities of kindness, compassion. They are, again, we said it in so many ways and so many times. They're actually really shifting this perception. Last bit. So
keep
much
going. It's
here.
Fine.
Is it
it's
okay,
fine.
Last bit?
Yeah, it's fine.
So sometimes it's really helpful to see, okay, there are teachings pointing to something. You're speaking about smiling. You're speaking about meeting the suffering. Meeting the person who does incredible harm to others with love.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
To also see there is an understanding operating. Our current understanding literally can't grasp.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we still look through our current understanding. Yes. And how is this possible? If do this, then da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and to really, you know, what I think can be really, or spoke to me, is like, and I shared this a lot of times, and maybe I just want to bring it in. So several years ago, 10, 15 years ago, I went to hear the Dalai Lama speak in the Albert Royal Hall in London. And he mentioned, and I think he does this quite regularly. He mentioned a meeting. So when he is in Dharamsala in North India, he will receive new refugees from Tibet, and he will have a conversation with them. And he mentioned meeting one monk who was imprisoned by the Chinese and was tortured.
Yeah, I know.
You probably know it, yeah. And the Dalai Lama asked, what was for you the most dangerous moment? What was the moment where you feared the most? Yeah, something like this. And apparently the monk answered, so the Dalai Lama said, when there was the danger to hate my torturer. My conceptual mind can't get it. You know. However, what landed a little bit in this moment was more, what is the understanding operates, a deep, deep understanding, a radically different understanding, where this makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Where this makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something, again, it's so counterintuitive. We can't fathom it in our normal shaping.
Mm.
And we can get glimpses.
Mm.
You know, and you know, many of you will have, in their practice, will have really seen that something is really seen suddenly very differently.
Mm.
And our conceptual mind will say very easily, don't trust this.
Yeah.
Don't trust this.
Yeah.
This is how it really is, you know. So I just, no. So we cannot just plug something in and think we have to really, really question actually permanently, how do we see it? And is there a way of holding, receiving it, meeting it, that actually opens something up? And sometimes we can't, because we're really in it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So am I right in thinking that when you're listening to the Dalai Lama, and he was telling the story about the monastic who was tortured, And talked about the scariest moment being when he was getting close to hate. So if I'd have been listening, I'd have considered myself to be somebody that might have loosened the chains. So I'm looking at the cave, I've had the support of the Sangha, and I'm loosening my chains, and I've just turned around a little bit. However, I can't turn round totally, or virtually totally, so I can't see everything. Is that sort of a very simplistic but visual sort of image of what's just occurred, or not?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I understand the question. I think what happened, you know, we have our discoveries, and to really cherish them, you know, these openings and bigger freedom and more choice and more capacity to really, really bow and cherish to them. And not as a dismissive, not in a superiority or inferior thing. It's like, oh my God, my understanding is still like, as my niece would say, pillepalle.
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 You created a new word.
But not in a dismissive way, but also more like, oh wow, that's exciting here. Mm. What is actually spoken here about?
Mm.
Yeah, what is actually, say, I rephrase it, what is actually understood here deeply? I do not understand yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is not about, again, becoming a better a better being, no. So.
And to help us with that, discussion, what Thay would say would be, get a yellow sticky tape, put it on your study wall, or wherever you work, or wherever you live, or wherever you write, or wherever you think, and on the yellow sticky tape, put, is my perception true? It will allow us to continually question and look in my sort of vision of what Joseph Goldstein, a little bit further. Is that right? Is that is it true? Is my perception true? Totally, always questioning. And to help us with that questioning, yellow sticky tape, is my perception true? And that's something that's on my study. It's there all of the time. Is my perception true?
Again, something I shared several times. Wasn't always easy. My friend Bobea would say, Kirsten, can you see it differently?
A kind.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes no thank you. Leave me alone. I'm quite comfortable in my way of painful perception. Yeah. But it's again, it's very closely, but it's really, it's this whole notion, You know, we are actually looking for, oh, this is how it is, this is how it is. And we are not provided by the teachings with this. That's other right. Than it's depending on how we perceive it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is nothing, oh, now, this is now really how it is. This constant, yeah. And also to really get the confidence, what is more helpful here? Opening it really up. And I won't make it on my desktop. Can you see it differently?
I'll have a look.
I have it in my head.
I'll have a look. Oh, I'm quite visual. Uh-huh. I'd just like to go back to the mind of love. It's about, isn't it? It's about how we're seeing things at the time. So if I can stretch my heart, if I can develop compassion, then I will see things in a different way. I don't know about you, but we're all sort of slaves of the email nowadays, aren't we? And sometimes when I have eyes that are irritable, because my body is tense, then the email that I respond to looks a different way, and the email that I write, I'm getting smiles. I've touched something here. Yeah. Might not be as kind as it could be if my heart was more open. What I do is obviously there is the draft box. Yep. So just as a simple thing, if you are mindful enough and you feel that you're a little bit tense, always use the draft box. We've spoken a lot, and when Kirsten and I have spoken about this retreat, we very much wanted to take people into their heart and into their body, rather than shooting up into this mind of ours, which is so helpful, but sometimes it's useful to go somewhere else with our attention. So bearing in mind that we have spoken quite a lot, and we started to get a bit heady, didn't we? We started to get
interesting. I'm not sure if I got. Your heart is still there, isn't it?
Yeah. We got a little bit. And I'd like us to, for the last 5 minutes, just to sit, just to let us come back to our body, to our heart. You'll be using your minds quite a lot, I suspect, over the coming weeks. When I breathe in, I know I'm breathing in. And when I breathe out, I know I'm breathing out. Breathing in, knowing. Breathing out, knowing. When I breathe in, I calm my body. When I breathe out, I smile. Calming, smiling. Dwelling in the present moment. I know this is a wonderful moment. Present moment. Wonderful. Now, dear friends, we have time for walking meditation until 9 o'clock. So please enjoy your walking or your sitting.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.